This accident was clearly avoidable.
The first findings from the commission investigating the Deepwater Horizon blowout. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, January 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, state lawmakers file legislation they hope to make into law ahead of their session that begins this month. Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Help manage subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing in Alaska. Apply for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide critical advice to the Federal Subsistence Board on the management of subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing on federal public lands. The deadline to apply is February 18th. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Legislators have already filed 104 bills for consideration in this year's session that begins on January 18th. On top of that, they have proposed 6 changes to the state constitution. APRN's Dave Donaldson has a quick look at the measures.
The various bills cover changes to a wide spectrum of the state's statutes, from driver's licenses to the university's Board of Regents to the State Personnel Board. Among those likely to get the attention of other lawmakers is one that would add 9 synthetic drugs, now legally sold under the names K2 and Spice, to the list of 2A substances covered under the state's criminal system. Another would give local residents a fishing priority when an area has otherwise been restricted, and several bills would keep drivers from using cell phones in their cars. Several bills that didn't make it through the previous sessions are coming back. Homer Republican Paul Seaton has introduced his rewrite of the state's mining tax, gaining importance to members of both parties as plans for the Pebble Mine and other new projects begin to show serious financial potential. Wrangell's Peggy Wilson has reintroduced her Transportation Infrastructure Fund that would channel money to road, harbor, and other transportation needs. Oil taxes and energy projects are also on the table, from a rewrite of portions of the state's tax code to providing energy grants to small businesses. And health care could become an interest, with bills introduced that would effectively bypass the national health care bill, to providing a state system to negotiate drug prices directly with manufacturers and working through local pharmacies to lower medical costs. The bills will be formally read into the record and assigned to committees when the session begins. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
The commission investigating the Deepwater Horizon blowout will release their full report next week. One key chapter has been released this week. Former Lieutenant Governor and Chancellor of the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fran Almer, was on the commission. Although she can't yet talk about the full report, she says it's clear that process safety protections for the high-risk industry were not in place. She says the U.S. does not do as well in this area as other countries.
Other countries, for example, Norway and U.K., require an analysis of the risk of a particular well and a system on that rig, what they call a safety case, that would enable the people who are working on the rig to be able to test certain things that are happening against their risk profile. That was not in place on the Deepwater Horizon. And I think not only in retrospect, but for purposes of being able to make recommendations about improvements for the future, we need to see some big changes, both in how industry operates in deep water, but also how government regulates deep water drilling.
Let's talk about that for a moment. The commission found that government regulators didn't have enough staff or enough training to police the industry. How is it that the people didn't have adequate training on the government regulator side?
Lori, I think it's a combination of things. First of all, the industry has moved into deep water in the last decade or so with very sophisticated technological developments that really are very impressive. And unfortunately, at the same time that this technology was evolving and the industry was developing new ways to drill for oil in deeper waters, there wasn't a commensurate level of investment in making certain that the federal agencies had the kind of expertise that was needed, did not have the financial support from Congress, frankly. There is a really interesting chart, which I will mention, that you will see once the full report comes out, that looks at the rapid rate of number of rigs in the Gulf of Mexico, particularly in deep water drilling. At the same time, it shows you the flat level funding for the Department of Interior.
The commission found risk-reward standards and cost-cutting tactics. How pervasive were these practices?
Lori, that's a really hard question to answer because, you know, we didn't survey the entire industry. We were primarily focused on this particular rig, this particular well, this particular incident. There were a number of decisions. I think there are nine listed in the chart that was released this week, that demonstrate really a judgment that was made as to whether or not it was safe to proceed in shutting down the well. And although any one of those should have been kind of a warning, at least a yellow light, if not a red light, when you look backwards and see how many of these things all should have signaled caution and yet didn't, you realize that there are a number of things going on in the management of high-risk operations that need to be reviewed. And we have no reason to believe that this was only on this rig or just these companies.
Let's take one of the examples. There was spacers involved that the specs called for 21, only six were used. Were you able to track who made the decision to change the number that were called for, and did a government regulator sign off on such a change?
Government regulators are not required to sign off on many of the decisions that are made on the rigs. They really couldn't because it's kind of a constantly changing environment, and there are many people at both on the rig and at central headquarters back in Houston that are participating in these decisions. There are some standards that are required by government, but many of the choices that get made on a rig or in a particular well are based on a balancing of how much time, how much money, how much risk, and what is available. You know, our job really wasn't in a liability sense to try to cast blame or find the person that made the wrong decision. We were really looking at the root causes.
With this particular well, would there have been a way to safely take it offline? It sounds as if there were flaws built into the system there.
Yes, this accident was clearly avoidable. It was something that at any point in the last week or two of the temporary shutdown procedure could have been, the result could have been altered.
The situation in the Gulf is vastly different than the prospect of offshore drilling here. We're not talking about deep water drilling in Alaska. But did the commission, during its research, look at comparisons in other places?
The complete report, which will be released next Tuesday, does address the future of offshore drilling, not just in the Gulf of Mexico, but in the Arctic and in other places.
Former Lieutenant Governor Fran Ulmer speaking about her work on the Deepwater Horizon Oil Spill Commission. Ulmer says commissioners will be traveling to New Orleans to report their findings to the people of Louisiana, then passing the report to the Obama administration and Congress next Tuesday. Links to the partial report are at our website, aprn.org. Alaska State Troopers yesterday flew from Nome to Little Diomede to respond to a situation involving firearms and allegations of arson. Ben Matheson from KNOM in Nome has more.
Troopers arrested Vincent Akinga and transported him to Nome. Trooper Sergeant Andrew Merrill.
There was evidence of arson, and there were shots fired.
Merrill says a 15-year-old juvenile was injured by contact with broken glass while running away from a Kinga. The individual was treated on diamide and required no further medical attention. Troopers chartered a helicopter yesterday afternoon, but weather conditions and the location of diamide made for a challenging response. Merrill says that while troopers traveled to the island, local residents assisted in securing the situation.
During the incident, he had a firearm and there were multiple crimes that occurred. Several community members secured Mr. Akinga until we could get there.
Akinga was arraigned this afternoon at the Nome Courthouse. Akinga faces charges of arson 2, assault 3, and assault 4. Akinga's next court appearance is scheduled for January 14th. From KNOM in Nome, I'm Ben Matheson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Coast Guard member is honored 68 years after his action.
Is it true that your grandfather was saved by Douglas Monroe? Is that true?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com.
The former pastor of the Catholic Church in Sitka will not face any criminal charges in connection to questionable material found on parish computers in November. Father Edmund Peniston was removed from his job as pastor of St. Gregory's Catholic Church in mid-November after software programs alerted church officials to possible pornographic material on computers at the parish. Sitka Police Lieutenant Barry Allen says investigators at a state-run computer forensics lab did not find anything on the hard drives that would warrant criminal charges. Father Pat Travers is spokesman for the Diocese of Juneau, which oversees the parish. He said Peniston remains at a church-affiliated residential facility in the lower 48 for evaluation. The diocese did not disclose where specifically. An updated post to the diocese website says Bishop Edward Burns learned this week that no charges would be filed and that the diocese would continue working to determine if Peniston is suited for ministry. Prior to arriving at St. Gregory's in October, Peniston worked at Holy Name Parish in Ketchikan. Earlier this week, the Alaska Seafood Cooperative and other seafood organizations filed suit against the National Marine Fisheries Service to block the new rules aimed at protecting the far western stock of the endangered Stellard sea lions. The rule, which went into effect on January 1st, closes Area 543 in the western area of the Aleutians to fishing for Atka mackerel and Pacific cod. Seven of Alaska Seafood Cooperative's ships fish in Area 543, and they represent about 90% of the area's Atka mackerel quota. Their attorney, Linda Larson, says the co-op does not think the new regulation is justified.
The agency is taking these actions based on concerns about a subpopulation in the Western Aleutians, which is the outlier in terms of the stability of the population, and that population is in fact decreasing. But they're taking these very drastic, very restrictive measures to shut down huge areas of the Aleutians to any fishing at all for Atka mackerel or cod without stepping back and taking a look at whether there were some other things that they could do that would allow fishing to continue and satisfy the uncertainty about what's actually causing the Stellars not to be doing so well in the Western Aleutians.
The population of Stellar sea lions is increasing in other areas of the state.
Atka mackerel and Pacific cod are not overfished. There's nothing to indicate that there is so much removal by the fisheries that Stellar sea lions aren't getting enough fish. That's where we really differ with the agency. And when we look at the science, we just fundamentally don't see a conservation emergency or any sort of change in situation that calls for such a drastic change in the management of a fishery that impacts so many people.
NIMFS itself estimates that communities and companies involved in the affected fisheries could lose between $44 and $60 million per year because of the fishery closure. Though the agency cannot comment on pending litigation, a spokesperson says the rule was pushed forward and put into place by January 1st despite objections from the North Pacific Fishery Management Council because NIMFS had to be in compliance with the Endangered Species Act. According to that legislation, NIMFS is required to manage the ground fish fishery in such a way as to not cause jeopardy or adverse modifications to the critical habitat of endangered sea lions. In this case, it meant protecting the vital food source for the western stock of marine mammals. Fishing for Atka mackerel and Pacific cod typically starts in late January, but will not this season. Larson says that they are trying to expedite the case and have it heard by the same judge who will review a similar suit made by the state of Alaska against the regulation in December. The judge will review the documents that NIMFS had before them when they made their decision and will read briefs and arguments filed by both sides. The case should take a few months to go through the system if expedited. Larson says they have not decided whether or not to file an injunction to try to fish this season. A 22-year-old Coast Guard signalman died more than 68 years ago helping defend a beachhead being overrun by Japanese forces at Guadalcanal. On Wednesday, he was honored on the Kodiak-based high-endurance cutter that bears his name. KMXT's Jacob Resnick reports from Kodiak.
There was pomp and circumstance as fellow Medal of Honor recipients, top Coast Guard officers, and crew members from the Cutter Monroe and Kodiak Air Station gathered aboard the 378-foot vessel to pay tribute to the man whose likeness has been molded into a bronze bust. Douglas Monroe is still the only Coast Guardsman ever to receive the Medal of Honor, the highest military honor awarded by the U.S. government. For Douglas Monroe is credited for selflessly positioning his small craft between advancing Japanese forces and troop ships evacuating U.S. Marines from the beach during the important 1942 battle at Guadalcanal. Commander Nathan Podal recounted the events of that September day.
Douglas Monroe's mission was to evacuate a group of Marines who had been surrounded and under intense fire from a Japanese force. Please stand for the reading of the citation. Monroe, put in.
But it was the Coast Guard's highest-ranking officer in Alaska, Rear Admiral Christopher Colvin, who brought Monroe's actions home to Kodiak. He singled out a petty officer assigned to the Kodiak Air Station, who is a direct descendant of one of the 500 Marines saved by Monroe that day.
Petty Officer Francis, is it true that your grandfather was saved by Douglas Monroe?
I know these things.
Is that true?
Yes, yes.
So you wouldn't be here today, maybe, if Douglas Monroe didn't do what he did.
Yes, sir.
Remarkable. Absolutely remarkable.
The Admiral then offered the backstory of why Monroe was being honored on this particular day. January 5th isn't the anniversary of the ship, the date of the battle, or even Monroe's birthday. Rather, it was during last September's performance by actor Gary Sinise's Lieutenant Dan Band that a Medal of Honor recipient, retired Army Major Drew Dix, visited the cutter and remarked that the small framed photograph of Monroe seemed inadequate as tribute for an important figure in Coast Guard lore.
Drew was on board Monroe when he looked around and he said, hey, there isn't much here to recognize Douglas Monroe, and that's not right. And so he got together with Dave McIntyre and said, what can we do about this? And between the two of them, they made it happen.
The Dave McIntyre he mentions is the CEO of TriWest Healthcare Alliance, a private company contracted to provide coverage for Coast Guard personnel and their families. TriWest paid for the bronze bust, just as it helped pay to bring Sinise's band to Kodiak. McIntyre said during last September's visit, he and Sinise agreed Douglas Monroe deserved to be honored.
This all came to pass because we had the chance to come up and spend some time here in September on a beautiful sunny day. And during that time of bringing entertainment, we had a chance to spend some time on the row with the great staff here, and a chance to learn about Douglas and the amazing things that he did as a coaster.
Dix said a common thread among Medal of Honor recipients is that any sense of accomplishment is tempered with a healthy dose of humility.
The one thing that I'd like to make very clear, that I know these men very well, and not one of them consider themselves to be a hero. And I know if Douglas Monroe was here, he would say the same thing. He figured that he was just doing what had to be done on that day.
The bronze will be permanently placed on display on the cutter's mess deck. Around its neck hangs a reproduction of the Medal of Honor. The original remains in the Coast Guard Museum in New London, Connecticut. I'm Jacob Resnick.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com, and by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Eight men are vying for the Matanuska-Susitna Borough Mayor's position in a special election set for next Tuesday. According to Borough Clerk Lonnie McKechnie, that's a big field of candidates.
Well, a mayoral candidate has to receive more than 40% of the vote, and if one candidate does not receive more than 40% of the vote, the two top candidates go forward to a runoff election.
The borough mayor's job pays just over $19,000 a year, plus expenses. The vacancy came after former borough and mayor Talis Kohlberg resigned last year to take a job with the Matanuska-Susitna campus of the University of Alaska. The winner of the upcoming mayor's election will fill out Kohlberg's term until October of 2012. The borough mayor's duties are in part to preside over borough assembly meetings, breaking tie votes if necessary, and presenting the face of the borough at local ceremonies. A hired manager presides over borough day-to-day affairs. The Yukon Quest is less than a month out, and the field stands at 30. Top racers in the mix include defending and four-time race champion and speed record holder Hans Gott, 2009 winner Sebastian Schnula, and past runners-up Hugh Neff and Ken Anderson. The latest roster changes include the addition of rookie Jody Bailey of Chattanooga. Bailey will join her husband Dan Caduce, a Quest veteran, on the trail. Meanwhile, work is well underway on the race route. Alaska side race director Marty Story says snow is a little low in the Fairbanks area, but overall the trail is shaping up.
There's crews that have been putting portions of the trail in all winter. Once the Yukon River froze, there was a trapline crew that put in a portion of the trail to the 40 mile, and depending on where the snow and where the trails are, people have been grooming trails since the winter started.
The Canadian military is back, preparing the Quest Trail on the other side of the border. The Rangers have long been involved in grooming the race route, but did not work the trail last year. This year, the Rangers are partnering with the Quest again, and Canadian side race director Georgina Leslie says their experience is valuable.
The Rangers have put our trail in for a while, so they have a consistency and a knowledge about the trail that's very beneficial. So we have that they know where the trouble spots are, and they know where what to look out for, and can manage. They have their teams already in place, so it's very well coordinated.
The Canadian Rangers use a three-phase process to put in the Quest Trail, starting early with brush clearing and packing with snow machines. The second phase, closer to race time, reestablishes the trail, while the third step, called proofing, done just before the race start, provides a final touch-up. The 2011 Yukon Quest begins in Whitehorse, February 5th. The state of Alaska is honoring a couple of Alaska schools for their success in boosting student achievement. One of the schools is in the Bristol Bay region. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The Manicotic Nunatak School, which is part of the Southwest Region School District, and the Two Rivers School in the Fairbanks North Star Borough have been named National Title I Distinguished Schools by the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. The school in Manicotic was recognized for making significant progress in closing the achievement gap between student groups in the Alaska Native, economically disadvantaged, and limited English proficient categories. Herman Gerving has been the principal of the Manicotic Nunatak School for the last 5 years.
I would like to congratulate the community, families, the children, our school, all our staff, and anybody associated with this school and community for an honor that is just outstanding. And I still don't know if we've reached to the level of how important this award is.
The award is specifically for Title I schools, which receive federal funds to support programs designed specifically for low-achieving students in schools with high poverty rates. To be eligible for the award, the two schools chosen had to have a poverty rate of at least 35% and exceed the state standards for making adequate yearly progress for two or more consecutive years. Gerving says there are several reasons for the improvement seen at the Manicotic Nunatic School, including a dedicated staff that has remained fairly stable in recent years.
I think that's a huge element. I have been pretty fortunate. I have 15 staff members, and I usually have two or three. It wasn't the right fit for them, and they move on, and I get new ones in, but a majority of my staff are here. Another issue is, I think, at the administrative site. You know, I'm here now for my fifth year. I think that makes a huge difference.
In honoring the Manicotic Nunatic School, the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development pointed to several things that have been done to help improve student achievement, including partnering with local organizations, extending the school day, and professional development for teachers. Gerving says the increase in student performance in recent years could not have happened without the hard work of the 123 or so students in the school.
And I think that's where some of this student-led, because we do have a very active student council, and they are, you know, they're involved in the school and keeping the school running. And I think that has bought them something that they can say, hey, this is ours. And I know in the last 4 years it's just been a huge change in student attitude that way. I mean, we still have, you know, it's increased a lot, of course, and we still want to go a long ways yet, but I think that has to change. Yep. The students' attitude have to be for education, and I think we've accomplished that here. And students have to have a buy-in. And again, that comes back from the parents supporting us. You know, if the parents support the school and who's working here and the community supports it, that makes it look a little better, because then the kids see that. Whereas if a parent wasn't negative about the school or a teacher, they'd see that too, you know. So it's a whole community issue here.
The last school report card for the 2009-2010 school year noted that 62% of the students in the Manicotic Nunatic School were proficient in math, and the attendance rate at the school was over 91%. The graduation rate was nearly 67%, which is well above the state target of just over 55%. The announcement about the two schools being named Distinguished Title I Schools was made Friday by Les Morris, the acting commissioner of the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Two Rivers Elementary School in the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District also shared in today's National Title I Distinguished Schools recognition. Two Rivers was recognized for exceptional student performance for two or more consecutive years. The Two Rivers School is 30 miles outside of Fairbanks. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson in Nome, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Mike Mason in Dillingham. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering access to online courses from any location. Spring semester starts January 20th. Information at distance.uaf.edu.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.